We have with us live in the KODX studios once again, Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, local writers and activists, here to give us a wrap-up of this past week's news. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
It is
a chorus of good afternoons.
Yes, we'll have to work on that.
It's so good.
Does that qualify as an a cappella?
No.
No, a cappella is without accompaniment.
Oh, okay.
So no musical instruments playing.
This is why I didn't. Okay.
We could sing it a cappella.
No, let's not.
Let's not do that. We've heard Maria sing before. Let's not repeat that.
I'm the one who can't sing.
All right. So lots of local news, national, international, all crisscrossing. But
So let's start at the top. Okay. We do this occasionally with people who passed away who we think are significant. And for people who haven't heard, the first confirmed death of coronavirus in the United States was announced this morning at Everett Hospital in Kirkland. So
Evergreen,
that's what I meant. You know, our condolences to the family of the victim. We don't know who the victim was yet. That hasn't been identified. It could be one of the two cases that was announced last night in Mill Creek and Shoreline. Governor Inslee referred to the victim as a he, which would be the Mill Creek team. President Trump, in his comments this morning, referred to a woman in her 50s, a wonderful woman in her 50s, because he was trying to fake empathy. That would be the case in Shoreline. And the Washington Department of Health has also said that there are several new cases that have been confirmed in Washington State that we don't know about yet. So the King County Department of Health is having a press conference at 1 o'clock. It's live streamed on their Facebook page.
And we shouldn't probably be surprised by this because, you know, we're on the West Coast. We're the Pacific Rim part of the United States. And there are a lot of folks who live in King County who have relatives in China and who travel to and from China.
Or South Korea, as the case was the case with the Shoreline.
As was the case with the woman in Shoreline. Yeah. So I think we can expect, as the coronavirus spreads, that Seattle and San Francisco, the Bay Area, will probably be the initial hotspots here in the United States.
I think so also. It's very likely. We're going to get a lot of attention, national and international.
Yeah.
And we'll be getting back to this subject.
We'll
talk about this later in the show. Give some more context and all that. But first, we have a lot of local news.
We do.
Starting out with the winter eviction bill.
Yeah. Mayor Jenny Durkan did not sign the winter eviction bill that was passed unanimously by city council a couple weeks ago.
She returned it to the council unsigned.
You know, she returned it to the city clerk unsigned.
Yeah,
and
which means that it's going to become law in 30 days, regardless of the fact that she didn't sign it, even though it lacks the mayor's signature.
Yeah, and I think it's also maybe a statement of intent as to how aggressively her administration will actually enforce that law. But and that's something we'll have to monitor. But the council passed it by a veto-proof majority. Yeah.
And to be clear, the winter evictions ban isn't an outright ban, so there's no enforcement action required by the city. What it is it's just another defense that a person who is undergoing eviction can use in court in order to prevent themselves from being evicted during the months from December 1st through the end of February.
Right. Which is today. I think this is the first show I've ever had on a February 29th.
Yeah. Now, Durkan's letter gave three reasons for why she didn't sign the bill. First of all, it said that it won't be effective, but she didn't cite any support for that assertion. Secondly, she said that the city might have to defend the law in court, although the bill was amended in several different ways in order to make it more easy to defend it in court. And she said, finally, her third reason was Durkan wants to spend more money on other quote-unquote solutions that in my opinion, don't directly address the problem of evictions in the wintertime. And then the only solution that she cites that the city is going to be putting more money to is to give $200,000 to the United Way for their home base program. And this is after Councilmember Andrew Lewis specifically requested as his conditions for voting for the bill, that the mayor find more money for, that the mayor find money for this program in particular, which provides rental assistance to low-income people who are facing eviction. Homebase, I should point out, is run by the United Way, and they have taken in millions in donations from local businesses and foundations. So I'm not sure why they also need taxpayer money, too. Now, it might be a great program, but as I said, I don't see why the city would donate to a nonprofit instead of funding more of its own programs, like more enhanced shelters and tiny house villages to help with homelessness and people who are evicted, or rental assistance programs that are run by the city rather than one run by a nonprofit.
I don't think Durkin wants to put any more money into those kind of programs. By the way, I just got a text alert. Governor Inslee has declared a state of emergency over coronavirus.
Yeah, okay. Okay, so that's what I have for the ban on winter evictions. It's interesting mm-hmm. that Durkin didn't want to sign the bill, but she didn't want to veto it because, of course, she knew that she would be facing an override of her veto by the city council, and I guess she just didn't want to get into it.
Yeah, much of the last few months has been about her trying to take power away from the council.
Yeah.
So I don't think she wants to set that precedent.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I would expect if that did actually happen, the council did override her veto, that wouldn't show up in her weekly Durkin Digest.
No.
I'm just guessing here.
No.
All right. Well, sticking with city council, there was a very spirited discussion this week with HSD.
Yes, with the acting director. Director of HSD, Jason Johnson.
Human Services Department.
Human Services Department.
Thank you.
Who oversees homelessness issues, among many other things, in Seattle. And he was grilled very strongly about the pretty much disastrous quarterly report that came out last week, I believe. And I think we talked about it
On the navigation team.
On the navigation team.
And he was sitting there at the table with navigation team director Tara Beck, and they were answering questions from the city council members. But Tara Beck at one point claimed, quote, that every person the navigation team engages with is offered shelter, end quote. And both Shama Sawant jumped on that. Shama Sawant jumped on that and said, I don't believe you. And Mosqueda responded, we're having a hard time accepting that statement.
Yes.
She was
That's a more politic way to do it.
She was more diplomatic.
Yes.
And so looking at the fourth quarter, and I looked at the fourth quarter 2019 navigation team report, it says that only 6% of the people that the navigation team, quote unquote, contacts actually gets in off the street. That's a total of 45 people in the last 3 months of 2019. Remember, there's 10,000 or more people in King County who are living on the street. And remember, too, the last quarter of 2019 is when the weather starts to turn cold for winter. Now, the sweeps that are done by the navigation team are done during the day when most people aren't in their tents. So a much higher number of people actually lose their belongings in an encampment sweep and are not contacted or contacts made by the navigation team are not offered any shelter at all.
And a big reason for that is that, the vast majority of sweeps are done without any advance notice.
Yes.
It's supposed to have 72 hours notice, but Durkin has found a loophole where she can decide that it's a public health threat or something like that. And it wouldn't surprise me at all if the coronavirus, one of her responses to the coronavirus update is to try to scatter as many homeless people as possible.
Well, of the 303 encampments that are listed in the fourth quarter report, they say that they swept 303 encampments. Only 11, or just under 3%, were given 72-hour notice as required by city ordinance. Now, the report also showed that there are only 12 shelter beds available on an average day in Seattle, and 5 are in basic shelters, which many homeless people won't accept.
Yes.
Also, no new City of Seattle shelters or shelter beds opened up during the fourth quarter of Seattle, and during the fourth quarter of 2019 in Seattle. Now, I find that frankly shocking, given that the city has declared homelessness an emergency, that in the fourth quarter of 2019, that in the fourth quarter of 2019, when the weather was turning cold and you would expect that the city would want to get people off the street, that not a single new shelter opened that was run by the city of Seattle.
And a lot of this is default because the Regional Homelessness Authority is still setting up. Mm-hmm. They don't have a CEO yet. Maybe by next winter they'll have some sort of coordinated response.
Which kind of plays into the argument that opponents of the Regional Homelessness Plan have made, that it's just a delaying tactic and it's going to set back the effort to get people in off the street while the city and county shuffle around and try to get the new agency up and running. And that has proved to be the case.
Yes.
Now, at one point during the hearing, Johnson infamously said that if the city were to build more enhanced shelters in tiny house villages, this would create another bottleneck in the system further down. People would have temporary shelter, but there wouldn't be enough permanent housing for them. And
there isn't already enough permanent housing.
And that led to a lot of groans in the audience when he said that, because, of course, no kidding. We've known for a long time that the lack of affordable housing is the cause of the problem.
And the city has been extremely resistant to try and either identify that as the cause of the problem or take any steps to make that situation better.
Yeah, but the response to Johnson's clueless comment is that at least having more enhanced shelters and tiny house villages is housing people at least temporarily. People would get in off
much
the street.
Safer.
Yeah.
They have a community.
And it would address complaints by the public and by businesses that, you know, those people are living on the streets. This is horrible. You know, it's disrupting business or it's an eyesore, et cetera. It would address that issue. It would also be humanitarian. It would get people in off the streets.
It would save lives.
Most importantly, it would help, as you said, save lives. It would help to get services to those folks that they need. For example, mental health care services, drug addiction treatment, alcohol addiction treatment.
And there's a lot of shortages in all those availabilities,
and
too.
To help people get their lives back in order. You know, a lot of people are being pushed out on the street, not just because of rising rents, but maybe they've suffered a health crisis and they're having trouble paying their medical bills. They need regular treatment, just regular medical treatment. That's something that can be addressed when you get them into a tiny house village or into an enhanced shelter.
It's also a place to store their stuff.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Where it won't be stolen by the city.
And the reason that homeless people prefer the tiny house villages is because they have a private place that they can lock, where they can sleep at night and where they can store their belongings. And that's not something that basic shelter offers them.
And, you know, being homeless is not a picnic. It's really a strain. Some of the mental health and substance abuse programs, it's a chicken and egg thing because people self-medicate. Getting people off the streets would be the first step in helping that.
Yeah. And so Johnson seemed to be, in that moment, just declaring himself the gatekeeper, literally the gatekeeper who's preventing many homeless folks from getting access to services and shelters. In other words, just sweeping them around the city from one neighborhood to another in order to avoid his own and Mayor Durkin's bureaucratic problems. And that's really unacceptable. And that led to a lot of people calling for his resignation. So it was no surprise that he resigned on Friday.
He resigned on Friday. He'll be there still until June.
Yeah.
And what really jumped out at me in Durkin's statement about this is she'll begin the search process immediately. Well, he's been an interim director for 2 years. Isn't there already a search process? And it tells you how happy she was with the job that Johnson was doing and that it reflected her priorities.
Yeah. So I think we can assume that she's not going to do a nationwide search as she had initially promised to the staff of the Human Services Department that she would do.
Yeah. And that staff, Johnson was originally nominated to be the permanent director, and that nomination was pulled because of enormous staff opposition.
Well, partially enormous staff opposition, but also because Shama Sawant, who was the head of the committee that would have brought his nomination up and voted on it and the city council, she refused to bring up his nomination for a vote.
Yeah.
For consideration and a vote. And so Durkin took it back, essentially, and said, okay, I take back the nomination. Johnson's going to be the quote-unquote permanent interim director, is what she said. So and I guess the question is she going to promote another one of her cronies in, or promote another person who agrees with her in the Human Services Department to be the permanent interim director, or is she going to really propose someone and do a real search process? That's the question.
And find someone who has some expertise in treating homelessness as a humanitarian issue rather than a law enforcement issue.
Yeah. And so in the meantime, Councilmember Sawant said that she's going to introduce a bill to sweep money away from the navigation team and into tiny house villages. Councilmember Mosqueda, I want to point out that Mosqueda now chairs the budget committee, said that she'd be evaluating each quarter whether the money spent on the navigation team could be better spent elsewhere in the city budget.
And, you know, I've made this point before, but this, the winter evictions bill and some other things, it's why it's so important to have Sawant on council and put the lie to the criticism that she doesn't work well with colleagues. She does.
She does. Yeah, and so I also kind of want to point out that the navigation team's days may be numbered now, or Durkin may end up having to move them into the Seattle Police Department to be funded under their programs as a smaller team that focuses strictly on clearing real hazardous sites and real obstructions, not fake ones, as the navigation team has been doing, which is probably where they should have been all along.
Yeah, and we should point out that most of these sweeps are done through SPD.
Yeah, well, with SPD overseeing the sweep.
Yeah.
I've seen a couple of them in action, one of them in my neighborhood just near where I live, and it was essentially a police officer directing a couple of city personnel to pick up and trash bag all of the belongings of a homeless person who was sitting in his wheelchair watching as they did it. That was the sweep.
Wow.
Yeah.
And credit to Erica C. Barnett for being the first person to report the resignation of Jason Johnson.
Yes.
And she also followed that up with pointing out that one of the people from that department sitting with city council that day, August Drake Erickson, has also announced her retirement just shortly after Johnson's.
I would highly recommend Barnett's blog, The C is for Crank, for local, especially local city news. She's been on top of a lot of these issues, very much so.
She does a lot of freedom of information requests, public record requests, and interviews people, tries to get information out of the city government that you just are not seeing. We're just not seeing the Seattle Times and other media sources like our TV news stations, local TV news stations, doing any of that work.
Well, the thing is that Barnett has been here she's been a reporter here for at least 15 years that I know of, probably longer. And I remember when she first came to Seattle Weekly and then moved to The Stranger. So that was in the late 90s. So she has a lot of experience as a reporter. Most of the people that the Seattle Times are assigning to local news, with a couple of exceptions like Daniel Beekman and Sydney Brownstone, don't have a lot of experience, don't have a lot of institutional memory of what goes on in Seattle. And that's true for all the TV reporters, basically.
Yeah, unfortunately, to save money, a lot of these large media outlets assign local stories and research to interns who just don't have the background and don't have the long-term experience to understand the foundation for a lot of what's going on locally in local politics. So that really does make a difference.
Yep. And we do, so.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. Moving on, SPD.
Yeah.
Firing an officer.
Carmen Best announced the firing of an officer after an internal investigation found that he'd repeatedly made derogatory and discriminatory comments about women, gay people, and people of color in remarks and texts to his former girlfriend and her son, Todd Novacedlak, butchered that name, sorry, is 55 years old. He's been in the department for almost 30 years. Also was found to have physically abused his ex-girlfriend and to have smoked pot in violation of department policy, based on witness statements from the ex-girlfriend, her son, and her daughter. I'm glad that this particular person is no longer an SPD. My concern is that he has gone through 6 years, at least, of reform process without being checked on any of these kind of behaviors. And I think there's probably a lot more people in SPD like that. The resistance against reform has really come from the Seattle Police Officers Guild and rank and file officers. And there's a cultural problem at SPD, and it continues. It's probably getting a little better, but and until that's addressed more systematically, we're going to continue to see cases like this.
Well, you could argue that it's not getting better if you look at who they elected as union president, right?
Well,
or SPOG.
Yeah. Well, I was talking about the overall membership of the officers, the 1,100 or so officers. But yes, SVOG.
That's what I'm talking about.
Yeah, SPOG is going to continue to be an impediment to the reform process, and they're now negotiating a new contract while the contract Jenny Durkin proposed is still languishing in court, waiting for the judge to send it back.
Yeah. And with the union election of a new president who is very conservative and very much against police reform, I think we can expect those negotiations to drag on and to not make a whole lot of progress.
Yeah, and it really makes Carmen Best's job much, much harder.
Yeah.
All right. Also, an update to last week's Chase Bank protest.
Yeah, a week ago Wednesday, there was a big TP in the middle of 2nd Avenue in front of Chase near Union. And that was protesting Chase's investment in Canadian pipelines. The protesters were mostly First Nations people from Canada and their allies. It turns out that they did a prayer walk the day after, at which there was some unexpected violence, and SPD arrested one of the walkers. And that's the sort of thing that happens outside the public eye that is again a real problem for people who want to express dissent. It's like SPD is taking revenge against people that made them look bad the previous day, even though they're no threat at all, really.
Yeah.
All right. And then we'll be getting to the state legislative update. But before that, cover the new EIS.
Yeah.
From the feds.
No surprise, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers and the federal government, including the EPA and other federal agencies, recommended not, they released their draft environmental impact statement on the lower Snake River dams, and they recommended not removing those four dams. And their reasons for that was that they had four reasons. First, that power rates would go up, although it's an estimated 9.6% for quote-unquote wholesale customers. And I'm thinking, okay, wholesale customers, you're talking about
Boeing.
Very large businesses, right, primarily. And agricultural customers. Number two on their list was clean power from hydroelectricity could be replaced by dirty power that produces more CO2. Notice that's a hypothetical there. It's not a necessarily what would happen. Number three reason was that the water needs of big agriculture are more important than protecting salmon runs from extinction in their mind. Because some of the largest orchards in eastern Washington draw water from eastern Washington, eastern Oregon draw water from behind those dams. And the final reason is that barge traffic from Lewiston, Idaho relies on the presence of those four dams. Again, business interests trump those of the state's most iconic wildlife.
And this goes back to the announcement last year by the Trump administration that they would gut the environmental impact process and start considering economic factors and weigh those against the ecological factors.
Clearly they've done that in this case.
Yes.
Those four dams are, for folks who are not familiar with them, the Lower Granite, the Little Goose, the Lower Monumental, and the Ice Harbor dams on the Lower Snake River. Washington State has spent about $18 billion to restore salmon habitat in our state, but fish and wildlife biologists agree that removing dams and other barriers to fish passage really helps a lot more than anything else that the state has tried in terms of restoring salmon habitat.
Yeah, that's what the scientists say, and the Trump administration is not real big on science.
Yeah. Now, restoring fish runs would help, of course, to save the dwindling orca pods that live in Washington State's offshore waters. And they have gotten a lot more press lately than salmon runs. But, of course, most of the Snake River and the Upper Columbia River remain off limits to salmon because of the presence of dams along the Snake River and Columbia River, including those four dams on the lower Snake River. When the last environmental impact statement was issued on those four dams in 2000, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration recommended the removal of those four dams to ensure the survival of Columbia and Snake River salmon runs. By far, I should point out, by far the largest salmon runs in the state of Washington and in this entire region. Now, the new draft environmental impact statement is currently in a 45-day public comment period, with the final report and decision on the dams expected to be issued in September. So you can find the draft environmental impact statement on the EPA's website. You just go and search for it. It's called the Columbia River System Operations, EIS. You can submit a comment to the EPA, or you can attend one of the public meetings that will be held. The Seattle meeting is set to be held on Thursday, March 19th, from 4 to 8 p.m. at the Hilton Hotel at SeaTac. That's at 17620 International Boulevard.
Yeah, in SeaTac. And we'll announce that again closer to the date.
When it comes up.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But it's funny that they seem to be emphasizing the economics of those dams. And if you look at the economics of them, they actually cost us significantly more money than they generate, to the tune of, I think it's like around $200 million a year.
The key thing that you said there was costing us as opposed to costing businesses.
Yes. Well, it's a, you know.
They're public facilities. Public facilities require maintenance and operations, and that money comes out of taxpayer pockets, whereas the economic benefits go to very few large businesses, agriculture businesses, and businesses that rely on barge traffic down the Snake River from Lewiston.
And also businesses in the entire Pacific Northwest that use a lot of electricity and don't want to have to pay slightly higher rates.
And don't want to convert to green sources of power like wind and solar and perhaps tidal power, which I think we should develop more of in Washington State, and we just haven't been.
Yeah.
All right. And now, without further ado, we move on to this week's update on the state legislature.
Yeah, just some deadlines this week. This week, on Friday, yesterday, was the deadline, February 28th, was the deadline for bills to be introduced on the House and Senate floor from other chambers that passed other chambers, except for budget and transportation bills. This coming Monday, the 2nd, will be the last day for budget and transportation bills to make it out of their committees to the House and Senate floor. And then on Friday, the 6th of next week, will be the last day for each chamber to pass bills that were already passed in the other chamber, with the exception of budget bills and initiatives. Now, that means this coming week's going to be a mad scramble on the floor of the House and the Senate to pass as many bills as possible that had already been passed in the other chamber, to get those bills sent off to Governor Inslee to sign. So a lot of, you'll see in the press, a lot of bills passing and some coverage of what bills have passed the legislature. That's going to be a mad frenzy of voting this week. Now, Thursday, March 12th is the last day of the session. That's the following Thursday. The final 6 days will be for work on the supplemental operations budget and transportation funding bills. So once this coming Friday rolls around and all those bills have been passed, the next weekend is going to be a mad rush to finish the budget and the transportation bills. So the question is, what budget and transportation funding bills have been proposed? The Senate has passed Senate Bill 6168. That's the Senate's supplemental operating budget for 2020. It includes $1 billion of new spending added to the state's $52 billion budget, which was passed last year. Much of that new spending is focused on three priorities. affordable housing and homelessness services, behavioral health, mental health funding, and funding for programs to address climate change. It includes $115 million for new homeless shelters and rental assistance for low-income families statewide, $100 million for a new UW Behavioral Health Hospital. That was one of Governor Inslee's priorities to address problems with the state's mental health system, but that's just one of his priorities. It includes $128 million for K-12 education to plug the gap in the new state public school funding formula that shortchanges some school districts and not others. It includes $116 million for affordable childcare, foster families, and early learning programs in the state. Now, the Senate is also working on a supplemental transportation budget that's meant to address the shortfalls caused by Tim Eymann's I-976 $30 car tap fees, and plus a long-term decline in the gas tax revenue. The gas tax is our main funding mechanism for the transportation budget, and it's not a secure funding mechanism because, of course, as we know, the state is focused on transitioning people from driving gasoline-powered vehicles to driving electric-powered vehicles, and that's going to have a heavy impact on the gas tax revenue. But the Senate's bill it only provides a short-term one-time fix for the transportation budget by moving monies around within the budget, particularly from reserves. And that's not a long-term fix. Senator Steve Hobbs, who worked on the bill, warned that come January, the state will have to find a new revenue source for transportation funding or risk making deep cuts to roads, bridges, and transit projects if Eymann's I-976 is upheld by the state Supreme Court.
And one of the coronavirus's possible impacts is on state revenue because it relies heavily on sales tax.
Yes.
Which we'll get to.
Yes. Now, the House supplemental operating budget was similar to the Senate's, but it provides higher funding for housing and homeless services. The House supplemental operating budget would set aside $235 million for housing and homelessness services versus $115 million in the Senate version. It also puts $100 million into the state's housing trust fund to build affordable housing, which I think is absolutely critical right now in getting people off the street. The House budget also put $75 million for more homeless shelters and services for the next 5 years versus the $115 million for homeless shelters and rental assistance in the Senate budget. The House budget would put $56 million to pay raises for child care providers, which I think is really critical for providing support for child care and early learning services in the state. And the House budget would also restore funding to temporary assistance for needy families, in other words, welfare, in Washington State, because funding has been cut to TAMP for a long time. So it's essentially trying
at both the state and federal level.
Yes, it's essentially trying to help support people who would otherwise be kicked out on the street in multiple ways by providing rental assistance, more affordable housing, as well as more cash assistance to people who are needy.
Yeah, and hopefully those provisions make it all the way through and are signed into law.
Yeah, and stay in the budget. There's still going to be a lot of negotiations on these bills and a lot of amendments that will change the funding formulas and where the money's going to go. So we'll keep you posted.
Yep. By the way, if you appreciate the information that we pass along on this show or any of the other fine shows on KODX, which is 24/7 volunteer run,
that's right.
We rely on you, the listener, to help feed the gerbils that, you know, run the wheel that keep the whole thing going.
right.
So if you can, we very much appreciate donations. If this kind of information is important to you, you can go to the website at kodxseattle.org. There's a Patreon
button at the top. And there's a PayPal button at the bottom.
Or you can mail checks to Earth on the Air Independent Media at
P.O. Box 45883, Seattle, Washington, 98145. Send a check just like Deborah did, holding yes. right in front of me.
Yeah.
So
that's awesome.
Yes, thank you, Deborah.
And I want to also point out that we do, as people who listen ahead of when y'all arrive, we air a lot of the previous content that you would hear on Mind Over Matters in the morning on Saturdays. But we also re-air a lot of stuff on Sunday mornings, also Mind Over Matters content, including this show. This yes. What we're recording now will re-air Sunday mornings at 9 and then Monday evenings at 6. So,
and it's also available on the website or your favorite podcast provider.
Yeah, right. So if you've only been listening to the show on Saturdays to hear us and other content from Mind Over Matters, keep in mind that the station is on 24/7 now and has some great content during the week.
Yep.
So we'll be with you no matter, you know, assuming we continue to get funding.
Survive,
we'll be with you.
Yeah.
Yeah, no matter what's happening out in the big world. So there you go.
Okay.
So speaking of the big world.
Yes.
Well,
let's go to national.
Our world. There was a debate this week, which... I mean, I haven't seen all of them, but that had to be the worst run debate that I've ever heard.
it was pretty bad, and the job of the moderators.
Just to put some context, the Democratic debate in South Carolina.
Yes, it was the 10th one of these debates. So you would think moderators would be able to learn from previous moderators.
You would think,
but they didn't have control of it. They didn't ask good questions. And, you know, the upshot of it was you had 7 candidates on stage because Tom Steyer, who didn't qualify for the last debate, did qualify for the one in South Carolina where he's put a lot of time in. But you really didn't learn anything new about them. So you didn't really get a lot out of this debate, as opposed to, I think, a lot of people thought that the debate in Las Vegas the previous week was, as well as being lively, was very, very illuminative.
Probably the best debate.
Yeah.
Yeah, there you go.
So, yeah, if you watched the South Carolina debate and were turned off, go back and look on YouTube or other sources for the Las Vegas one.
Yeah. And South Carolina is holding its primary today. And in 3 days, we've got 14 states, including some really large ones, that will be voting on Super Tuesday.
California and Texas in
yes.
particular.
Yes.
And Virginia.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. North Carolina.
Yeah.
These primaries will award far more delegates than have been already awarded, which is why you see a lot of candidates hanging in, at least through Super Tuesday, in the hopes that they can get a bump from that and continue their campaigns. Of the major candidates, I think the ones most at risk of dropping out after Super Tuesday, if they don't do well, are Amy Klobuchar, who doesn't have a lot of the big funding that a lot of the other candidates have, and possibly Elizabeth Warren, especially if she feels Bernie Sanders has a clear path to the nomination.
Yeah, Warren's funding has been lagging since Sanders won the first two.
Yeah.
Although I could swear I read today that she pledged to hang in there till the big event.
Till the convention.
You know, I trust her on a lot of things, but I don't necessarily believe her on that.
Yeah, we'll see. We'll see.
But Super Tuesday is going to be absolutely
yeah,
key.
I think there's also some question about Biden as well, because I yes. know that he's been struggling to keep his funding levels up.
Yes, and he's been relying on doing well in South Carolina, and the latest polls have him up by double digits. So
we'll
he's
see.
Expected to win today.
Yeah, so we'll see. And if he does win, we'll see how his funding does as well. I know that his campaign has been shuffling around the mess, trying to figure out a good message that can help him carry a win from South Carolina into Super Tuesday.
Well, he doesn't really have a message other than I'm the only one on this stage who was there when fire was invented or whatever, and his association with Obama, which is important to a lot of non-white voters. But the thing that was significant about Sanders' victory in Nevada last week was that he was hugely popular among non-white voters there. Nevada was 30% Latino and another 10% African-American.
And I think that really goes to his ground game. He has an enormous number of folks supporting him who are willing to go out and organize in local communities and get folks doorbelling and holding fundraising events, et cetera. He's just got the, I think, superior ground game to any other candidate in the race.
Clearly. I think Buttigieg also has a very good ground game, but I don't know what how much he's invested in Super Tuesday states. He clearly did well in the first couple states as a result of his ground game. So we'll see.
Biden's, trying to compete mostly with Buttigieg in positioning himself as the moderate alternative to Bernie Sanders, and we'll see how that carries into Super Tuesday.
Or whether Mike Bloomberg's saturation ads have an impact. Because anybody who has seen him in person is not likely to vote for him. And frankly, the debate in South Carolina didn't change that.
No.
It wasn't as bad as the one in Nevada, but it was disturbing, shall we say. Yeah.
Bloomberg might be another one that drops out of the race after Tuesday. And the only reason I would hesitate having any belief behind that is several people have pointed out that he's made no ad buys beyond Tuesday. So, interesting strategy there. Although he's got enough money where he can then do ad buys at any cost, you know.
Yes. At any time.
Yeah. And he has been focusing on Super Tuesday states all along. He's not even on the ballot in the first four states.
Yeah.
So it'll be interesting to see how he does on Super Tuesday.
One of the things that did come up that was mildly interesting at the debate was him announcing that Russia was essentially funding Bernie or supporting Bernie's campaign.
Well, Russia is certainly trying to support Sanders' campaign. We've seen congressional briefings to that effect. Sanders, unlike Donald Trump, has entirely disavowed that and, you know, told Russia he doesn't want their help. I don't know if that'll make any difference. But Russia's goal in all of this is to sow chaos in the American electorate. And they may be calculating that Sanders is the easiest person for Trump to beat. They may be calculating that a Sanders nomination would be most divisive for the American electorate.
Yeah, and I think the divisiveness factor is key there, that they're looking for who is the most extreme in each party to support, and they view Sanders as extreme, whereas those of us who have some experience with the Democratic Party and with U.S. politics view Sanders as simply someone carrying forward sort of old liberal, progressive foundation of the Democratic Party from the Roosevelt era, because he really supports some of those key sort of Roosevelt era policies.
And that's really key to emphasize, because some people are put off by the Democratic Socialist label and or conflate it with communism, as Donald Trump has been consistently doing and his allies.
Yeah.
But Sanders really, most of the programs that he espouses pull very well with Americans. They're very mainstream.
Mm-hmm.
It's just that Congress in the past 40 years or so has not at all been reflective of what the American public wants, and has been steadily trying to transfer wealth from people who don't have wealth to people who have too much wealth already.
Yeah, and the Democrats have been moving further to the right in order to encompass those Republicans that have been alienated by the extreme right-wing turn of the current Republican Party.
And I
think that's something that maybe Russia doesn't understand as well as those of us who have had experience with American politics for decades do.
And you know, part of the problem with the Democratic leadership moving right, that's why they're so scared of Sanders.
Yeah.
And you're seeing institutional opposition to him coming out now. It'll be interesting to see how that plays out. I think if the national leadership of the Democratic Party manages to force through a moderate who has fewer votes than Sanders, it's going to make a lot of people angry.
Yeah.
At the same time, you know, the key here, whoever is nominated, is to have some semblance of unity, because beating Donald Trump is paramount if you want to have another presidential election with anyone else on the ballot.
All right. Well, and some of that was, again, evident this week with his response to the coronavirus.
Oh, Lord. well, let me first update. I got some updates from the King County Health, and actually Dow Constantine was there, and a bunch of other people were there as well. And
they had their press conference
they
today.
They had their press conference.
The nerve of doing it while we're doing our show.
I know.
I know. Fortunately, we have modern electronics here.
A cell phone.
Yeah, exactly.
I left mine in my purse turned off so it wouldn't interrupt the show, but John has his on mute.
Yeah, exactly. you know, the usual yeses and noes about how people can protect themselves. A new term, social distancing, which is to say don't hang out in crowds.
Yes, and that's one of my key ways to keep from getting sick is to hang out in crowds and then wash my hands frequently, especially after coming in from being mm-hmm. out in public.
Yeah.
And try not to touch your face.
And they're talking about, canceling large public events. I would imagine that would include sporting events once baseball season starts and
political rallies.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. How convenient.
Yeah.
Well, I guess it's a good thing.
We have our primary a week from Tuesday, so it won't be an issue after that.
Yeah.
Yeah. And we don't actually meet at polling places anymore. So,
yes.
Yes. I think this is an instance where not queuing to vote is a good idea, and having people fill out paper ballots and mail them.
On the other hand, it also likely means the city won't look favorably on large political events, such as protests, when people start rioting over what Trump is doing or not doing.
Yeah.
And the coronavirus is really very disturbing. There was a spokesperson from Evergreen who talked about they're having updated testing guidelines. The person who died from the virus and the other cases that have been identified were done based on symptoms or recent travel, not necessarily from a definitive CDC test, which has two problems. One, they're not very definitive. And secondly, it is several days for them to get them back. And the woman who died this morning obviously didn't have a chance to get that back.
Well, yeah, up to this point, they've had to send them off the tests, the shoddy tests off to CDC, and it takes 3 to 5 days to get those back. And it was just last night that, Thursday night. CDC finally crumbled and said, okay, we're going to allow states to do their own testing. So now, theoretically, entities like Washington State and King County Health can do the tests and turn them around in 24 hours.
And the Washington Department of Health just got some new test kits like yesterday.
Yeah.
It shows you, given that this has been developing for 2 months, and we've been talking about it for 2 months, I've been certainly posting a lot for 2 months. I have a background in epidemiology, so once it started spreading in China, I knew exactly what the risks were. But a lot of public officials have been caught flat-footed by this, especially at the top of the federal government, where Donald Trump has been publicly downplaying the possibility of a pandemic that is now upon us. In order to please the markets, which hasn't worked very well, and in order to, stave off political criticism. He, at one point this week, called the coronavirus a hoax, new hoax perpetrated by Democrats who were out to get him, which is kind of insane.
It's like an echo of Richard Nixon's paranoia there.
Yeah, well,
you look at that and you go, "Oh my God, this guy is so paranoid now."
I don't think it's so much paranoia as narcissism, because he can't bear the thought that anybody would criticize him for anything, because he never does anything wrong.
Well, or that anything like this could happen during his presidency.
Yeah,
how dare a virus upstage him?
So it's got to be the Democrats' fault.
Yeah.
So other things from the press conference in the last hour, Dow Constantine, in addition to all the usual condolences, said this was a public health crisis, that he was the 19,000 King County employees across King County were going to be dealing solely with this in the future. I don't know what that means. He probably doesn't know what that means yet. But they're taking it seriously, which is a good sign.
Which is good. It's good that locally here in, I think, one of the two communities on the West Coast that will be the initial hotspots for coronavirus spread in the United States, here in Seattle and down in the Bay Area, that at least up here we're taking it seriously, unlike our federal government.
Metro announced that if there were any buses that were unsanitary because somebody pukes on the bus, I've seen it happen.
Yeah, I have.
They
too.
Will immediately pull the bus off and desanitize it.
Yeah,
that's a good step as well.
That's a good sign.
Let's see.
So people can get this information. There's a lot of sources out there for breaking news on the coronavirus. I think the important thing to keep in mind is that we not panic. That there are things people can do to halt the spread or to limit your exposure to it. One is to keep your distance from other people. 6 feet is a good distance to aim for. Another is to wash your hands as much as you can, especially after you've been outdoors.
20 seconds in hot water. Mm-hmm. Don't just put them
Use
under.
Use soap.
Just don't put them under a cold spigot for a couple of seconds and rub your hands. That won't do it. I should mention also a couple of the other steps that are being taken locally. There's also concern about spread of these cases among the homeless. And they're trying to set up ways to test people who have any symptoms in different encampments.
Given the struggles we have with providing services to the homeless, I think that's going to be an issue that we'll see a lot of debate about.
Yeah.
Not a lot of movement either.
Yeah, but I did kind of want to talk a little bit about the economic impact of the coronavirus.
We should put some context first. That mm-hmm. nationally, there are about, I think, 80 cases confirmed so far. It's increasing rapidly now, day to day. And we've had, in the last 24 hours, the second in suburban Portland, and the third with the person who was infected in Mill Creek. Cases where they have no idea where they would have obviously gotten the virus.
Yeah, and I think this speaks to my feeling and my understanding early on in the spread in China, that they were starting to see kids, they were starting to test kids who were only mildly ill, and they were finding evidence that they did have the coronavirus. So I think now that the virus has jumped from an animal population into a human population, that the reservoir is in younger folks who have stronger immune systems. They get a mild illness that looks like a cold or like a mild case of the flu, and that they're able to spread or may not get sick at all or seem to be sick at all, and that they're able to spread the virus around that way.
And one of the similarities between the spread in China and the potential spread in the United States has been the government at the top being very slow to respond. And we talked a little bit about that with Trump. His political appointees at the head of HHS especially have been, towing the party line that this is no big deal. And that's simply not helpful. And, given the climate of the Trump administration, people farther down, people with scientific expertise, know that they maybe have vengeance taken against them. They speak out and tell the truth. The White House announced this week that all announcements on the coronavirus epidemic will come from the White House, not from any scientists, but from Vice President Pence, President Trump, etc.
Yeah. And that makes me wonder about the CDC. The CDC's been trying to provide information for people for, what to do in case of the coronavirus. I'm hoping that they will continue to be able to do that. The CDC...
They have been barred from doing so.
Yeah, the CDC, I should mention too, in addition to being under a stranglehold from the White House, the CDC is underfunded and I think understaffed for a major pandemic like this. And that can be laid directly at the feet of Donald Trump and the Republicans in Congress.
Yeah, they've cut the budget for both the CDC and the National...
Attempted to cut the budget very deeply. And yeah. Democrats in Congress and some of the more mainstream, some of the less conservative Republicans have restored a lot of that funding, but they still have not seen the kind of funding that they need in order to staff up for a pandemic like
yeah,
this.
Yeah, and actually they laid off their pandemic experts,
mm-hmm, yeah.
which
I think
appalling.
We're going to see was a big mistake.
Yes.
Well, and to be fair, although the bulk of the blame with this, the current response is on the Trump administration. The U.S. has been cutting back on their hospitals and general support of this going back decades.
And public health funding.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And laying it in the hands of private, hospitals. And that's just not going to turn out very well.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
So we should probably talk a little bit about the potential economic impacts of this.
Yeah. And we've seen this week a big crash in the stock market, the biggest since the 2008 financial crisis. Part of that sentiment, people get being just very, very nervous about the coronavirus. But I think a large part of it, too, is an understanding that's beginning to percolate through the economy that there are going to be major disruptions in the supply chain. There have been temporary disruptions, what have been assumed to be temporary disruptions in the supply chain because of the closure of factories in China and the inability to get goods from and raw materials from and parts from China for our economy. But I think there's an understanding now that those are going to be long-term disruptions in the supply chain. And this is, I think, the first time in my lifetime that I'm beginning to see an economic downturn that's related to disruptions in the supply chain as opposed to disruptions in demand. So, for example, people's inability to buy stuff, which would be a disruption in demand,
which
in
was
our
which was
supply
basic,
and demand economy.
Which was basically the most recent downturn in 2007-8.
Yeah, yeah. Instead, for example, the 2008 crisis, people had heavy debt related to their housing with adjustable rate mortgages and the rates adjusting sky high, you know, making it impossible for those folks to pay their debts and impossible for them to buy stuff. And, you know, as we know, consumer spending makes up about 70% to 75% of the economy. So that was a demand.
Yeah. This
problem.
Having a supply disruption is really unknown territory for the U.S.
It is.
I don't think it's happened since World War II.
Yeah.
And we have a very different economy now than we did in World War II.
Yeah, and in World War II, we had rationing going on and so forth. But we also had a ramp up in demand for things like weaponry and supplies for
the
war.
And we had a manufacturing sector then that could adapt. Mm-hmm. And we don't now.
We don't now.
We
have a global supply chain that we didn't have then.
And much of it comes from China. Much of it is already in the process of being disrupted. Probably the scariest part of that is most prescription drugs in the United States come from China. And
the FDA has already announced that there's a shortage of at least one medication that's related to the coronavirus problem with the supply chain in China.
Yeah.
So I think we're going to see a lot more of that, and we're going to see a lot of other critical parts of the economy suffer from a lack from shortages in the supply chain.
The closest analogy to this is not SARS. Yeah, it is not Ebola, which the 2014 crisis in West Africa, actually there were only about 28,000 confirmed cases. We already have far more than that. It certainly isn't the swine flu or the bird flu. We haven't seen anything like this in our lifetimes. And the closest parallel, although there are important differences, was the Spanish flu between 1918 and 1920. That started and spread very similarly to how spread quickly, very similarly to how coronavirus spread very quickly. There was a lot of international travel going on at the time because we were in the middle of World War I. And the epicenter of that epidemic, found out afterwards, was an allied, very unsanitary, very crowded staging area for troops in France.
It's not called the French flu.
No.
It's called the Spanish flu.
Yes. That's because the United States and Britain and France and Germany all suppressed information as to how bad the epidemic was. Spain was neutral in the Great War, so it did not. So people initially thought that it was coming from Spain. That's a piece of trivia you can tell your friends.
And that's a lesson we should learn from this as well, too. Governments are going to deal with it differently, and that it could cause some real problems and cause the virus to spread.
And if you don't have confidence in the Trump administration, it's not a good sign.
Yeah,
but it is one reason I brought it up. Mm-hmm. You know, the other similarity between 1918 and now is the mortality rate. It was about the same as the coronavirus has been so far, but it infected nearly between one quarter and one third of the world's population at the time. So that tells you how quickly and widely it spread. Obviously, we have much better medical technology now. Many countries, Many developed countries especially have much better medical infrastructure, public health infrastructure. But, you know, we'll see how this goes. We're in unknown territory, and it's very concerning.
Events.
Okay, coming up, if you feel like hanging out in a group room with a bunch of strangers after that, we have a couple good events at Town Hall on next coming Tuesday. The producers of Outsiders, which is a podcast series tracing the growth of homelessness in Olympia, that they will be giving a talk that's free with an online registration. Upstairs in the same time, Joanne Bagshaw will be with Kirsten Harris-Talley on how to resist sexism and dismantle the patriarchy.
And when is that?
Those are both at 7:30 on Tuesday night.
Okay.
If you don't want to watch Super Tuesday returns because it's just too depressing, you'd rather risk getting a serious illness.
I don't think we're quite at that point yet.
No, we're not. We're not. And we should emphasize that most people who get coronavirus is relatively mild. Mm-hmm. The people most at risk are older people with pre-existing conditions, people who have immune problems.
And people who smoke or have other lung conditions.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I will plan on seeing you both back next week. So, assuming y'all take your vitamins and
hydrate
properly.
As long as you tell me.
I will plan to be here.
As long as you tell me where you've been in the interim.
I promise to wash my hands a lot this week.
Okay, I'll come back. Right. I promise.